All right. Welcome back, everyone, for another deep dive.
Always exciting to be back.
You know, these deep dives, they're like cheat codes for your brain, right? You get to absorb all this in-depth knowledge without spending hours sifting through research papers and articles.
Yeah, like a shortcut to becoming well-informed.
Exactly. And today, we're taking a deep dive into a topic that's been generating a lot of buzz. Cholesterol.
Oh yeah, cholesterol, always a hot topic.
It sure is, and we're specifically focusing on chapter 9 of this Dutch book called The Cholesterol Myth.
Interesting, why just one chapter?
Well, this book actually has 17 chapters, but chapter 9 really caught our eye because it dives into some pretty startling claims about how cholesterol research is often conducted and presented, you know.
I see, so it's kind of a deep dive within a deep dive?
You could say that.
And what exactly are these startling claims?
Well, let's just say it left us questioning some pretty fundamental beliefs about cholesterol.
Ooh, that's intriguing.
Like, think about this. The most read cholesterol study in 2016 was actually titled, LDL does not cause cardiovascular disease.
Wow, that's a bold statement.
Right. Talk about shaking things up in the cardiology world.
Makes you wonder if we're on the cusp of a major paradigm shift in how we think about cholesterol and heart disease.
Absolutely.
So how does this chapter back up such a radical claim?
Well, it starts by analyzing three reviews that actually support the traditional view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one that says LDL cholesterol is public enemy number one for your heart.
Okay, so the standard cholesterol hypothesis.
Exactly. But here's the twist. The book accuses these reviews of some pretty serious statistical manipulation.
Oh, so they're saying these reviews are basically cherry-picking data to fit a narrative.
Pretty much.
That's a serious accusation.
It is. And they go on to claim these reviews inflate statistically insignificant findings, downplay or even omit contradictory research, and even fail to mention a specific randomized trial that had results that didn't quite support the whole cholesterol hypothesis.
Okay, so they're claiming there's some serious bias going on.
Right. And they back it up with several examples, one being a Swedish study.
What did that study find?
This Swedish study looked at 15,000 people across a massive 20,000 municipalities.
Wow, that's a pretty big sample size.
It is. And they found absolutely no link between using statins and any change in the number of heart attacks.
Hmm, that's interesting.
And then there's the example from the U.S. where between 1990 and 2006, statin use went up, LDL cholesterol went down, but get this, heart attacks and strokes actually increased.
Okay, so that seems to contradict the idea that lowering cholesterol automatically equals a healthier heart.
Right, and the book even goes so far as to say, and I quote, "The idea that high cholesterol levels in the blood are the main cause of cardiovascular disease is untenable because people with low levels show just as much atherosclerosis as people with high levels, while the risk of suffering from cardiovascular disease is the same or higher."
Wow, they're not pulling any punches.
Nope, they're pretty straightforward about their criticisms.
But couldn't they be accused of cherry-picking studies themselves?
They actually address that concern head on.
How so?
They argue that the cholesterol hypothesis has been propped up for decades by reviewers who used misleading statistics, excluded results of unsuccessful research, ignored side effects, and dissenting observations of independent researchers.
So they're saying it's a systemic problem, not just a few isolated cases.
Exactly.
That's a pretty bold claim.
It is, and it makes you wonder, if lowering cholesterol isn't the be-all and end-all of heart health, what are we missing?
Right. What are the other pieces of the puzzle?
And that's another thing the book critiques about many cholesterol studies. They often tout impressive reductions in heart attack risk, but completely gloss over how these treatments actually affect lifespan.
Yeah, that's a crucial point.
Like, how many years are you actually gaining from these interventions?
Exactly.
The book criticizes these studies for ignoring life expectancy as a key outcome, and they even cite calculations suggesting that statins, on average, might only extend lifespan by a few days.
Wait, just a few days?
A few days. That's it, according to these calculations.
That's not very encouraging, especially when you consider the potential side effects.
Right. It makes you think about the bigger picture and whether those minimal benefits are really worth the risks.
Okay, I'm starting to see why Chapter 9 of this book is causing such a stir.
It's definitely thought-provoking.
But how do they actually back up these claims about misleading statistics? Can you give me an example?
They introduce us to this doctor, Dr. Hans van der Linde, who dug deep into the research data and found that the absolute risk reduction for dying from cardiovascular disease was a minuscule 0.16% per year.
0.16%, that's tiny.
It is, and to put that into perspective, the number needed to treat, or NNT, is a whopping 450.
Hold on, what's NNT again?
It basically means you'd need to treat 450 people with statins to prevent just one death from cardiovascular disease.
Oh, I see. So the actual impact on an individual's risk is pretty small.
Exactly. And Dr. Van der Linde doesn't hold back, saying doctors have been greatly deceived by pharmaceutical marketing.
Okay, now I'm really curious about this statistical manipulation thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mind bender.
How does it actually work?
Well, the book uses this hypothetical study to illustrate their point.
Okay, I'm listening.
Imagine a study with 2,000 men that finds a 50% relative risk reduction in heart attacks.
Wow, 50%? That sounds amazing.
Right. You'd think, sign me up.
Exactly.
But here's the catch, that 50% is what's called relative risk reduction.
So what's the difference?
By focusing on relative risk while ignoring absolute risk reduction, you can create this really impressive but ultimately misleading picture.
So it's all about how you spin the numbers.
Basically, yes.
And they're saying this tactic is used all the time to make research findings seem more dramatic than they actually are.
Exactly. And it's particularly misleading when you're talking about treatments with potential side effects.
Right, because you might be willing to tolerate some side effects if you think you're getting a huge reduction in risk.
But if that reduction is actually tiny, the whole risk-benefit equation changes. And that brings us to the famous Jupiter study, the one that claimed Crestor could reduce heart attacks by over 50%.
Oh, yeah, I remember hearing about that.
It got a ton of attention.
So what's the issue with it?
The book takes a closer look and exposes how, yet again, relative risk reduction was used to make the results seem way more impressive than they actually were.
So what was the actual reduction?
In reality, the absolute risk reduction was less than 0.5%.
Less than 0.5%? That's a far cry from 50%.
Right, and to make matters worse, the study didn't even consider potential side effects.
Oh, no.
In fact, it found an increase in fatal heart attacks and diabetes in the group taking Crestor.
Hold on. The group taking the drug had more fatal heart attacks.
That's what the study found.
That doesn't sound good at all.
Not good at all. And the book even proposes a rewording of the Jupiter study's conclusion to reflect the actual findings and potential risks.
I'd be curious to see that rewording.
It paints a much less rosy picture, that's for sure.
And this Jupiter study, it was widely accepted, right?
It was. And it's still cited today.
Interesting.
But here's something else. If you look up the Jupiter study on Wikipedia, you'll find that it mentions criticism the study received in a 2010 article in JAMA.
JAMA? That's a pretty reputable journal.
It is. And this article raised concerns about conflicts of interest and the potential for promotional bias in the Jupiter study.
So maybe we shouldn't just blindly accept the findings of these big, flashy studies.
Exactly. A little healthy skepticism is always a good thing.
Okay, so Jupiter's just one example. What other studies do they critique?
They also delve into the heart protection study.
And what did that one find?
It also used relative risk reduction to claim a significant reduction in heart disease and mortality.
But what did the actual numbers say?
A British doctor, Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, analyzed the study and found that the supposed benefits were really just delaying death by an average of 6 months.
6 months? That doesn't sound like much of a benefit.
And get this, 98.1% of participants received absolutely no benefit whatsoever.
Wow, so only a tiny fraction of people even saw that small benefit.
Exactly, and it really highlights the importance of looking beyond those attention-grabbing headlines and digging into the actual data.
So what's the takeaway here?
The book is basically arguing that using relative risk reduction instead of absolute risk reduction is a common tactic used to inflate the perceived benefits of treatments.
And that this is particularly misleading for patients who are trying to make informed decisions about their health.
Right, because they might be making choices based on a distorted picture of the risks and benefits.
It all comes back to that critical thinking piece, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Questioning what you're being told and seeking out different perspectives.
Exactly, because as we're seeing, the information we're given isn't always as clear-cut as it seems.
Okay, so what about those people who are told they need to be on statins for life? Is there actually solid evidence to support that?
That's another area the book delves into.
And what do they say?
They review the research on lifelong statin use, but point out a lack of truly long-term studies and some issues with the existing evidence.
So not a lot of solid data to back up that recommendation.
Right. They highlight one 20-year study claiming a 15% reduction in cardiovascular disease and a 12% reduction in mortality with pravastatin, which sounds pretty good on the surface.
Yeah, those are decent numbers.
But guess what? They found, yet again, that the study relies on relative risk reduction and there's no data on whether people actually stuck with the statin treatment for the full 20 years.
Oh, so we don't even know if people were actually taking those statins for the whole time.
Exactly. It's another example of how the research might not be as clear-cut as it seems.
This is getting pretty complicated.
It is, and that's why it's so important to be aware of these statistical nuances.
Okay, speaking of nuances, I remember you mentioned something about hard endpoints and soft endpoints. What are those again?
Hard endpoints are like the big undeniable outcomes. Death, heart attack, stroke, you know, the things you really want to avoid.
Okay, makes sense.
Soft endpoints are more like surrogate markers for disease things that might indicate an increased risk, but they don't necessarily mean you'll actually experience those events.
I see. So like a warning sign, but not the event itself.
Right. And the book analyzes a meta-analysis.
A meta-analysis? That's like a study of studies, right?
Exactly. And this one was by the Cholesterol Treatment Trialists, or CTT.
Okay. And what did they find?
They found that this meta-analysis combined hard and soft endpoints to make the benefits of statins seem more substantial.
So they were lumping different types of outcomes together.
Basically, yes. And when researchers like John Abramson separated the hard and soft endpoints, they found that the impact on those hard endpoints was actually minimal.
So lowering cholesterol might not actually lead to big improvements in those major health outcomes.
That's what the book is suggesting.
That's a pretty big deal.
It is. And they bring up another classic study, the MRFIT study.
What's that one about?
It's often cited as evidence for the cholesterol hypothesis, but they argue that it used something called relative differences to make the impact of cholesterol on mortality seem way more alarming than it really was.
So again, playing with the numbers to create a certain impression.
Exactly. And when you look at the absolute differences, the effect is negligible.
So it's all about how you present the data.
Right. And they even highlight how visual aids, like bar graphs, were used to further this misleading presentation.
It's amazing how even the way data is presented visually can be manipulated.
It is, and it shows how important it is to be really critical consumers of information.
So how did prominent figures in cardiology react to these criticisms of statin research?
Some dismissed concerns about side effects as just anecdotal evidence, which the book's authors strongly refute.
So they're basically saying, don't believe those people who are experiencing side effects.
Pretty much. And they even quote Dr. Ufer Ravenskov, an independent researcher who observed that nothing has happened despite documentation of fraudulent science.
So even with evidence challenging the cholesterol hypothesis, things haven't really changed.
It seems that way. And to really illustrate the power of marketing deception, the book revisits that Lipitor ad featuring Dr. Robert Jarvik rowing a boat.
Oh, yeah. I remember that ad.
It claimed a 36% reduction in heart attack risk, which sounds pretty impressive.
It does.
But as you might have guessed by now, the ad used relative risk reduction to create that strong message.
So what was the actual reduction?
The actual absolute risk reduction revealed only a tiny difference.
So once again, it's all about how you spin the numbers.
Exactly. And the book shows how visually presenting the data with bar graphs exposes this manipulation.
It's almost like a magic trick. You see this big impressive number and think, wow, this is amazing. But then when you look closer, the real benefit is much smaller than you thought.
It's a good reminder to be wary of those flashy ads and attention-grabbing headlines.
Absolutely. Critical thinking is key when it comes to our health.
This deep dive has definitely been an eye-opener for me.
Me too. There's a lot more to the cholesterol story than we're usually told.
It seems like we've only scratched the surface.
Definitely. And I'm curious to see where this conversation goes from here.
Yeah, it really is striking how often this pattern pops up using relative risk instead of absolute risk.
It's like they're pulling a fast one on us, you know, like a magic trick. You see a big percentage, like 50% reduction, and you think, wow, that's amazing. But then you look closer and the real benefit is like minuscule.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to understand the difference between relative risk and absolute risk. Relative risk just tells you, well, it just tells you how much the risk is reduced compared to some other group, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't tell you the actual size of that reduction.
Yeah, sure.
So absolute risk, on the other hand, well, absolute risk gives you a much clearer picture of the actual benefit.
So in that Lipitor ad we talked about, the 36% reduction, that sounds huge.
Right.
But if the absolute risk reduction is tiny, the actual benefit to any individual is practically nothing. Right. And that's a key point this book really drives home. We need to be looking at that absolute risk reduction to really understand the impact of these treatments.
It makes you wonder how many other medical claims are based on this kind of statistical yeah, I don't know, sleight of hand.
Yeah, it's a valid concern, and it really highlights the importance of, you know, critical thinking and independent analysis when we're looking at medical research.
It all starts to feel a bit like a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Are they saying the whole medical establishment is deliberately trying to mislead us?
I don't think it's necessarily about intentional deception. It's more about a system that's, well, vulnerable to various influences, right? Things like financial interests, publication bias, the pressure to get those, you know, positive publishable results.
So it's more like a system that's prone to bias, right, rather than some deliberate plot to, you know, mislead people.
Yeah, I think that's a more nuanced way to look at it. And that's why it's so crucial for all of us as, you know, informed consumers of information to be aware of these potential biases. We have to approach these research findings with a healthy dose of skepticism.
Okay, so we've talked about these misleading statistics, questionable research practices, but what about the science behind cholesterol itself? What does this book actually say about that?
Well, they dive into various aspects of cholesterol, the different types, you know, the roles they play in the body. They really challenge that traditional view that high cholesterol is inherently bad.
Interesting.
Arguing that it's a far more complex issue than just aiming for the lowest number possible.
That is interesting because we're constantly told that high cholesterol is like a major risk factor for heart disease.
Right. But this book presents evidence that challenges that simplified view. Like, they talk about how cholesterol plays these vital roles in various bodily functions like hormone production, cell membrane integrity, vitamin D synthesis.
So cholesterol isn't just this like evil villain lurking in our bloodstream waiting to clog our arteries.
Not exactly. The book argues that it's a crucial part of our biology, and just focusing on lowering it without understanding those nuances, well, it could actually be detrimental to our health.
That's a pretty different take from what we usually hear.
It is, and it certainly sparked a lot of debate. But they really encourage us to think critically about what we've been told about cholesterol and to consider these alternative perspectives.
This is all incredibly fascinating, but I have to admit, it's a bit overwhelming. Where do we even begin to sort through all this conflicting information?
That's a great question. I think the first step is to remember what we talked about with potential biases. You know, when you come across a study, an article about cholesterol, ask yourself some questions. Who funded this research? What methods did they use? Do the conclusions they're drawing actually match the data?
So don't just take things at face value. Do a little digging, even if it's just a quick Google search to see if there are other perspectives, criticisms out there.
Exactly. And don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. If you're concerned about your cholesterol levels, you know, talk to your doctor, explore the options, and weigh the potential benefits and risks of any treatment plan.
This deep dive has definitely made me rethink some of my own assumptions about cholesterol.
And that's the power of critical thinking, isn't it? It allows us to question what we think we know and be open to new possibilities.
Okay, so we've established there's more to cholesterol than we're often led to believe. And we've talked about the importance of being savvy consumers of medical information. But what about practical advice? Beyond focusing on lowering cholesterol, what can we actually do to improve our heart health?
That's where things get really interesting. The book goes beyond just cholesterol and explores a number of lifestyle factors that play a significant role in heart health. Things like diet, exercise, stress management, and even sleep.
So it's not just about taking a pill and calling it a day.
Not at all. The book really emphasizes this holistic approach that tries to address the underlying causes of heart disease, not just managing the symptoms.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk diet. What kind of dietary advice do they offer?
They advocate for a whole foods, nutrient-dense diet. Lots of fruits, vegetables, healthy fats, and lean protein.
Okay, so pretty standard healthy eating advice. Anything surprising or controversial in there?
They do challenge the conventional wisdom on saturated fat, arguing it's not the dietary villain it's often made out to be. They actually present evidence suggesting that saturated fat, in moderation, can be beneficial for heart health.
So butter isn't the enemy after all. I can get on board with that.
They also stress the importance of limiting processed foods, sugar, and refined carbs, which they say contribute to inflammation and increase the risk of heart disease.
So basically, ditch the junk food and eat real food. Got it. What about exercise?
They recommend regular physical activity, both cardio and strength training, to improve cardiovascular health and overall well-being.
Again, pretty standard advice. Anything more specific they suggest?
They do highlight the benefits of high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, which has been shown to be very effective for improving cardiovascular fitness and reducing the risk of heart disease.
Okay, I might have to look into that. What about stress management? I know stress can really do a number on your health.
Absolutely. The book talks about the link between stress and heart disease and suggests different techniques for managing stress. Things like mindfulness, meditation, yoga, and even just spending time in nature.
So taking time for self-care is crucial for heart health, too.
Exactly. And they also emphasize the importance of sleep. Chronic sleep deprivation has been linked to an increased risk of heart disease, so they recommend aiming for 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep every night.
Well, I know I could use a few more hours of sleep myself. It sounds like there are a lot of things we can do to take control of our heart health beyond just focusing on lowering cholesterol.
Exactly. It's about taking this holistic approach that addresses all aspects of our well-being.
So if we could boil it down, what's the main message the authors of The Cholesterol Myth want us to take away from all this?
I think their core message is that we need to be critical thinkers when it comes to our health. We need to be willing to question what we've always been told, to seek out different perspectives, and to advocate for ourselves.
It's about taking ownership of our health, not just blindly following the advice of experts or the latest headlines.
Exactly. We need to empower ourselves with knowledge and make informed decisions that align with our individual needs and values.
This deep dive has been truly enlightening. We've explored the complexities of cholesterol research, uncovered the potential for manipulation, and learned about a more holistic approach to heart health.
It's been a fascinating journey through a really controversial topic.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, I encourage you to continue exploring this topic, delve deeper into the information presented in The Cholesterol Myth.
Yeah, don't be afraid to challenge assumptions, ask questions, and seek out evidence that either supports or refutes what you're being told.
Great advice. And we'll be back soon with more deep dives into thought-provoking subjects. Until then, stay curious, stay informed, and as always, thanks for diving in with us.
So we spent this whole deep dive talking about this one chapter of the cholesterol myth.
Yeah, chapter nine.
And it's really made me question a lot of what I thought I knew.
Yeah, me too.
But where does this leave us? Are we like on the verge of a cholesterol revolution?
Well, I think like any big change in thinking, it happens gradually.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a growing movement of, doctors and researchers who are starting to question that conventional wisdom about cholesterol, right?
Yeah.
Advocating for this more nuanced approach that we've been discussing.
It's not just like a fringe group of dissenting voices anymore.
Not at all. There are a lot of studies and articles and books out there, like The Cholesterol Myth, that are, really challenging the status quo
Yeah.
and presenting, some compelling evidence for these alternative viewpoints. That's good to know. But for the average person who's just trying to, take care of their health, it can still feel pretty confusing.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to someone who's trying to navigate all this conflicting information
Yeah.
about cholesterol and heart health?
I think the most important thing is to be an active participant in your own healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't just passively accept whatever you're told. Ask questions, do your own research, and find a doctor who really listens to your concerns and is willing to discuss all the options with you.
So find a doctor who's more like a partner in your health journey, not just an authority figure.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that there's no one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to health. What works for one person might not work for another. It's about finding what works best for you based on, your own needs and circumstances.
And that might mean, challenging conventional wisdom, as we've learned from the cholesterol myth.
Exactly. Don't be afraid to think for yourself and advocate for your own health. You have the right to make informed decisions that align with your values.
This deep dive has definitely given me a lot to think about.
Me too.
It's amazing how one chapter of a book can challenge so many, well, so many ingrained beliefs.
It really shows the power of critical thinking and the importance of always, questioning what we think we know.
Absolutely. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this deep dive into Chapter 9 of The Cholesterol Myth. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have. From those misleading statistics to those alternative perspectives on cholesterol.
It's been a fascinating exploration of a complex, often misunderstood topic.
It really has.
And for our listeners, we encourage you to continue exploring this topic for yourself.
Yes.
And remember, don't be afraid to challenge assumptions, ask questions, and seek out evidence that supports or refutes what you're hearing.
And as always, thank you for diving in with us.